Shalom Aleichem. Assalam Aleichem. Namaste. Pax Cum Vobis. Sat Nam. Sat Sri Akal. Tashi Dalek. Ho Lilitanyan Wasi Yake. Welcome to the first meeting of our class, Introduction to Sabbatean Kabbalah. Actually, Introduction to Post-Lurianic Sabbatean Kabbalah, I guess, to be more exact about it. And let me adjust a little bit of our recording here so we don't max out everything. There we go. Good. I've just greeted you in 8 different languages. Here is what I said for those of you who aren't linguists or who haven't lived in all of these places. Shalom Aleichem is Hebrew for peace be with you. Assalamu Alaikum is Arabic for peace be with you. Namaste is Hindi for I bow to you. Pax Cum Vobis is Latin for peace be with you. Sat Nam, I'm going to give you that as an assignment for anyone who is interested to look that up and find out what that means and let me know. If no one does that, then I will let you know at our next meeting. Sat Sri Akal is Punjabi, the language of the Sikh scriptures, and it means God alone is truth. Tashi Dalek is Tibetan for auspicious greetings. And Ho Lilitanyan Wasin Yanke is hello, is Lakota, and it means hello, may everything be well. Now, why would I give these greetings in 8 different languages? So, and for those of you who are English, American, Australian, and virtually every country in Europe and elsewhere that uses English as a language of business, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. Why would I give greetings in 9 different languages? Well, to show the universality of what we teach. The name of our church is the Universal Sabbatean Church. Now, this doesn't mean that we believe that our church is universal. Rather, it means that what we teach is universal, that there are fundamental mystical truths that underlie all religions. There are things which, if you separate out all of the things, that the different faiths and the different religions disagree upon, there are certain things upon which certain fundamental beliefs and truths upon which they all agree. And this is what we talk about as being a universal truth. But let's remember something. God alone, as it says in the Sufi scriptures, Sat Sri Akal, God alone is truth. There are many paths to God. And Sri Ramakrishna, the 19th century avatar, Hindu avatar, said, there are many paths to God. And all of these paths, if sincerely followed and practiced, will lead one to God. But a path is not God. So we need to remember that God alone is truth, and that all of the practices and the rituals and the ceremonies and the moral precepts and the religious regulations and admonitions and everything else that goes along with religion, and all the discussions over dogma and creed, all of these things are not truth. And they are because God alone is truth. And they serve only, these arguments over these things serve only to separate us from ourselves and from God. And moreover, they trap God in religion. And that's why we say in the banner to this room that we are releasing God from the bonds of religion. Okay, so we're talking about universal truths that apply in terms of our relationship between man and God, in terms of that relationship. We are going to teach in this class those types of universal truths that apply whether you are a Lakota Sioux holy man or woman, or whether you are a Tibetan monk, a Buddhist monk, Shinto monk, a Hindu ascetic, whether you're a Christian, whether you are a Jew, or even, believe it or not, whether you practice voodoo, Wicca, or any of the other so-called pagan belief systems, because ultimately, in the end, they all are revelations of God, and they all have God revealed in them. Okay, enough of this. I want to lay down, as one of the first things that I do here, I want to lay down a few rules for this class. We need to have some rules, otherwise it'll be very difficult for me to teach and for you to learn. So please don't take these in a negative context. But of course, they contain, like any rules, some restrictions on our behavior. So here they are. First of all, everybody in this room is going to be red dotted except for me. This is a classroom. It's not a discussion group. I come here to teach, and hopefully you've come here to listen and to learn. Secondly, there will be no raising of hands unless I ask you to do so in response to a question or something. It interrupts my train of thought and it hijacks the conversation. Questions can be raised after the lecture portion is finished, when we get to the question and answer period. At that time, I will ask for questions and I will unred dot you, and you can type in, text in your questions, and then I will answer them to the best of my ability. Okay, third rule. No instant messaging to me or others in this room, for the same reasons I just mentioned, in that it interrupts my train of thought and hijacks the conversation. And I'm going to advise everybody here to set your Pal Talk preferences to allow instant messages only from your pals. Believe it or not, if you don't know this, you'll know this soon enough. If you're new to Pal Talk, you may not know this, but you'll know it soon enough. There are hostile people out there, quite a few of them, who will try to disrupt classes such as this. There are messianics, for example, both the Christian and the Jewish kind. Well, they're all basically the same thing. They're trying to go and get somebody and divert them from what they're doing and get them into what they're doing. They're trying to convert. They're proselytizing, trying to convert. And if they can't do that, then they think that anything they do is fair game and above board. They think that the ends justify the means. And so if they can't sidetrack you, they will disrupt the class. And they'll do that by instant, if they can't raise their hand, which they can't, because I've got it set that they can't do that, and if they're red dotted when they come in, and they can't do it that way, then what they'll do is they'll start instant messaging the people who are in the room to get them involved in conversations, because then they're no longer listening and learning. They are defending themselves from insults, usually, from these people. So you can avoid all of this, and my teacher had a good saying for a good name for these people. He called them fruit flies buzzing around. So if you wanna be not bothered by the fruit flies buzzing around, just set your Pal Talk preferences so that your instant messages can be received only from your pals, people in your pal list. Excuse me. Okay, the fourth rule, no clicking in or out of the room. It's distracting to everyone, and especially me, and since I'm the one that's trying to keep his train of thought and teach here, then that's very important, and it's just plain rude. If you can, please stay when you come here. Stay until we finish. It's only 30 minutes, 40 at the most, including the question and answer session. But people who come in and I understand this, that there will be people who come here who don't know what we're doing, don't know anything about us, and they'll listen for a couple of minutes and they'll go, well, this isn't for me, and then they're out of here. And I can understand that. That's not rude. But there are people, just these are in the fruit fly category, who will try to disrupt a room by coming into the room, staying for a few seconds, leaving the room, a few seconds or a minute later, coming back and doing the same thing, and just keep doing that. And it's distracting to everybody who's in here. So please, please don't fall into that category inadvertently. I know no one here would really want to do that intentionally. If you do, you shouldn't be here. Okay, that's it for the rules, but I have some advice concerning learning. Learning can't take place if you block out that which you don't want to hear or that with which you disagree. Now, you may be sitting there with your mouth shut, your ears are open, but nothing's coming in because you're carrying on an internal argument or dialogue or debate with yourself about the validity of what I just said or said just a second ago. And you're saying, oh, that doesn't sound right. I don't agree with that. What's he saying? He's saying this or that. Well, in the meantime, when you're going through that thought process, if you're a normal human being, that's what's occupying your consciousness, your conscious mind. And in the meantime, while you're doing that, you're missing what I'm saying. Your mind is divided, and you can only focus there in one place at a time, and so you miss out on what I'm saying. Now, what I'm saying subsequently to what you're thinking about or arguing with, debating about in your mind as to its validity or applicability or accuracy or truth, more about which in a second, while you're doing that, I may in fact be saying something that will clear up for you what you had a question about. But guess what? While others were listening, you missed it. And then you're going to ask a dumb question later. You're going to say, well, what about this? And I'm going to say, well, evidently you weren't listening. And I'll have some other people fill you in on what we said about that. And you might be embarrassed. Of course, I wouldn't do that intentionally now, would I? Okay, so what I'm getting at here is you have to open your mind, especially in spiritual learning and teaching. You have to open your mind by throwing out all of your preconceived ideas and let what we teach come into you. Let it be like a seed that's planted in a garden. Just leave it alone. After a while, of its own nature, it's going to sprout and begin to grow. When you look at it, you can determine whether it's a flower. And if it is, you can water it and nourish it and let it get larger and flourish. And if you look at it and decide that it's not for you, that it's a weed, then you can pull it out and you can move on with your life. Now, having said these preliminary things, I'm letting you know that this is the first time that we have taught this class in this room. And so, since this is a spiritual endeavor, I'm going to now consecrate this room to God, in whose service we teach and learn. Excuse me. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam shehekianu vekiyemanu vehigianu lazman hazeh. Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has granted us life, sustained us, and brought us to this season. Oh, main veil, oh, main. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam matir isorim. Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has made the forbidden things permissible. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Blessed be the name of his glorious kingdom forever and ever. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. Yea, you shall love your neighbor as you love your very soul. You shall guard him as you guard the pupil of your own eye. Lord God, we consecrate this classroom and the study that takes place herein to you and to the glory of your name and your kingdom. May your Shekinah be with us while we are here. May you grant to me your Ruach HaKodesh, so that what comes out of my mouth is only that which you have placed onto my tongue in the first place to teach. May you bless these students with a burning desire to know and cleave to you and serve you. May you grant us the endurance to continue on the path of righteousness, and grant us the strength to overcome whatever obstacles your left hand places before us. We ask these things for your glory, the glory of your name, and the glory of your kingdom forever and ever, in your holy name, as you have taught us to pray. Aheya, Asher Aheya, Omein V'Omein. Baruch Hashem, praise be to God. All right, we've taken up 20 minutes of our time here, so I will just give you some preliminary information about what we teach here. And we'll get into more of the teaching in our next meeting. However, about what we teach. Well, let's look at the name of the classroom. What are we called here? Well, it's called Beit HaMidrash. That's Hebrew. Beit is house. HaMidrash means the study, the learning, the instruction. Excuse me. Where did we get this name? Well, from a sect of very pious Jews, largely in Eastern Europe, that are called the Hasidim. The Hasidim is a word that's based on the Hebrew word Hasid, which means piety or pious one. This sect, which still exists today, in fact, you can see them still largely in mostly in large cities like New York. These are the ones that you see. You'll see them in TV movies and things. You see them, and they're also in Israel. You'll see them dressed in long black coats, flat, large brimmed hats, or fur hats, full beards, long curly sideburns called peyotim, and they still exist today. This sect is a part of Judaism. It's a mystical, pious sect, and it was founded in the mid-18th century by a man who's been called, most people refer to him as the Baal Shem Tov, which means his Hebrew for master of the good name. In southeastern Europe, I believe it was in what's now the Ukraine. At its height, just before World I, Hasidism, or Hasidut, as they call it, claimed several million adherents, or followers. Every village had a Rebbe. The Rebbe was a spiritual leader and a teacher. He was certainly those things. And he was usually also the decider of disputes, like a judge who ruled on matters of halakha, meaning law, Jewish law. In his teaching function, most of these had, either in the form of a large room or a small building, some of them had their own buildings outside of their house, usually next to their house, and in which the Rebbe's students gathered to study the Torah, debate, and argue, find points of interpretation with each other, and in the process, quite vehemently and passionately, I might add, but in the process, becoming closer to each other and also to God. And this place for study, whether it was a room or a separate building, was called Beit House HaMidrash, the Midrash of learning or study. And so that's the source of the name of our room. This room on Pal Talk that you're in right now and in which I am teaching is our virtual Beit HaMidrash, House of Study. All right. House of Study. Well, what is it that we study? What do we teach and learn? Well, basically, I can just boil it down to this. We study the Torah. Torah is the Hebrew word for instruction. And it refers to, more than the first five books in common usage. Now it's the Hebrew Bible, which includes the wisdom, the first five books, the Pentateuch, and followed by the books of wisdom and the books of the prophets, and the Christians call it the Old Testament. It's not old to us Jews, believe me. It's alive. It's a living document. And perhaps unknown to you, there's both a written version and an oral version. We study them both. I won't go into those differences right now. That's subject for later. We'll cover that later. But we don't study it to learn narrative history of the Jewish people, which is basically what the Christians do. They study it to learn about the history of the Jewish people. Why? Because their Savior, their Jesus, they claim to have been descended from the house of King David, David HaMelech. And so they want to put it into that context. And so they go through the Bible, through the Torah, looking for prophecies that they can say, hey, look here, this is talking about Jesus. Yeah, look here, this prophet, Daniel's saying this. He's talking about the coming of Jesus. Or Ezekiel, when he said, oh, yeah, that's all about this. The Christ is going to come back. The Messiah is going to come back in clouds of glory. Yeah, but that's not what we look at the Bible for. That's not what we study for, Torah for. And scholars will study it, you know, just to find out about Jewish customs of the Levant, the Levantine area, you know, the Canaanites, all these different tribes at the time. And they study it for historical purposes, mythological purposes, all kinds of other things that scholars are interested in. We don't study it either so that we can understand the 613 mitzvot and follow those mitzvot. Now, what is a mitzvah? What are the mitzvot? Singular is mitzvah. Mitzvot is plural. It's Hebrew for law, laws. That's about as laws. There are 613 legal, moral, and ethical rules that were given by God to Moses the second time he was on the mountain. Remember, the first time he came down the mountain, he brought two tablets on which were carved the covenant with God, the commandments given by God to his people, to the Jewish people. Moses came down, and when he came down, and it was carved, it says right in Torah, it was carved by the finger of God. And when he came down, he heard the noise. He and Joshua heard the noise. And Joshua was saying that it sounded like maybe a battle was going on in the camp. This is before they got there off the mountain. And Moses said, no, it's not the sounds of a battle. And when they get down there, what do they find? They find revelry going on, and the people are dancing, and there's all kinds of incredibly bad sexual things going on, and what are they doing? They're dancing around this golden calf that they had talked Aaron into making for them, Moses' brother, the high priest. Moses' priest, the spokesman for Moses, because Moses wasn't good at speaking, if you remember. So they come down, they see this, and Moses burns with anger, and he throws these tablets on the ground and breaks them. And after he takes care of the golden calf by burning it in a fire and grinding it up and mixing it with water and making all of the Israelites drink it and then castigating them and sending the Levites through the camp to kill certain people in punishment for this, he goes back up on the mountain and he begs forgiveness for the people by God. And God says, okay, but I'm going to give them another Torah. You did well to break the tablets, Moses, and I'm going to give them another Torah. They're not ready for the spiritual Torah that I gave them, which consisted of a single commandment. Listen to the Lord thy God, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people. No, they have to have, they're an obstinate, unruly people, and they have to have rules and regulations to purify them. And so Moses spent 40 days up there and nights, and God dictated, and Moses wrote it out. And that's the 613 laws that are largely found in the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. We're not here to study those and learn those. You want to study and learn that? Go to any Orthodox, conservative, or reformed, not so much reformed, but those other two especially, Orthodox or conservative branch of Judaism. Go to any of those synagogues, and the rabbis will be happy to teach you about those things on and on and on and on. Okay, why don't we study those things? Well, number one, we don't need to study them. Well, I mean, we don't need to teach about those things because that's a need that's already being filled by the rabbis in the Orthodox and conservative parts of the Jewish Hebrew religion. But that's not why we're here. The other reason is because we have been released from most of these rules and regulations. When Shabtai Zvi came in 1666, the only Jewish Messiah recognized by the whole of Jewry all through the diaspora, everywhere, recognized by every single Jew, by all reports. And this was reported on by journalists of the time. Christians, Muslims, reporting back, being sent by kings and other rulers to find out about this phenomenon, and they all come back and say, oh, this is what's going on. Miracles are being performed. And I won't get into all of this. This is a subject for another teaching. But what Shabtai Zvi did, he was the Jewish, the true Jewish Messiah. And what he did was he released us from that second Torah and reinstated for us the Torah de Atzilut, the Torah of emanations, the Torah of nearness. Nearness to what? Nearness to God. The spiritual Torah. So we have no need to teach that. And you have no need to learn that from us. You can go get that from wherever you want. Okay, so what do we do when we study the Torah? How do we study it? We study it in a mystical manner, mining it for its mysteries and secrets, which will elevate us spiritually to a higher level of consciousness, which will let us climb the ladder that Jacob saw in his dream. You remember that? He had a dream in which he saw a ladder reaching from heaven down to earth, and he saw angels going back up and coming down. Well, we too can climb that ladder. It's a spiritual ladder. We study Torah to find the keys to the gates that will let us enter those domains and precincts where those ladders are between the levels. We study Torah so that we can establish a direct relationship with God, one-to-one. As my teacher used to say, still does, mano a mano, hand-to-hand, one-to-one relationship with God. You have no need for a minister. No one does. God existed before ministers and priests and rabbis existed. When God talked to Abraham and Abraham talked to him, there weren't any priests or ministers around to teach him religion. No, we can still do that. And that's what God prefers. And we want this one-to-one relationship. Why? So that we can cleave to God. So that we can learn the secrets he has to reveal to us in our dreams and in visions. Let me give you an example. I've mentioned the word several times here of mysticism. That we study Torah in a mystical manner. And in fact, I will just say this. I am a mystic. People who follow this path, this is the mystical spiritual path. Okay? This is not the path of orthodoxy. This is the path of mysticism. And what do I mean when I say mysticism? Well, it means kind of what I've just described, looking for God in all the wrong places. The ministers tell you, you better be in church every Sunday. You want God in your life? Be in church. You walking with the Lord? Be in church. Let us harangue you and tell you what to believe. Be in church. Same thing with the rabbis. Be in the synagogue. Same thing with the mullahs. Come on Friday. I'll give you a sermon in which we talk about what jihad to go on next. Now, that's not fair to the mainstream Muslims. I won't get into that right now. But we live in radical times, and it's true for the radical zealots and fundamentalists who are doing the killing right now in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. So anyway, you don't need a priest, a rabbi, a mullah. You can do this yourself, and I'll give you an example, and you don't have to go to church to do it. You can discover God in your dreams. You can discover, and you can communicate too. And you can discover God in visions. He came to all kinds of people in the Torah in visions. He didn't just stop doing that. He speaks to us in dreams and visions in the night, but no one listens. That's what Job says. That no one listens. Well, we are here to teach you how to listen and how to respond. And you can see God virtually everywhere that you go in the world, in his creation. Every animal, every plant, even in the rocks and the stones and in the sea and in the winds and all the forces. And if you're a physicist, in all the laws of the universe. God is in all of these things. He is not these things. He's much more than these things. The Creator is much more than the creation. But he is in the creation. Let me give you an example of mysticism at work, okay? Of mystical interpretation of a piece of Torah. Let's think about, we were just talking about Moses and the two Torahs, the spiritual Torah that he broke when he came down, and the physical, the Torah of remaking, Torah de Berea, Torah of remaking, is made again. Okay, so we're on that subject. Let's talk about an incident that occurred after the giving of the making of the covenant between God and the people of Israel. They were in the desert. And the next order of business was that God said, I need a place to dwell among you. And of course, this suited Moses and the people just fine. They wanted their God to be with them. And so he said, make me a dwelling. The Hebrew word is mishkan, a sanctuary. Moses called it the tent of meeting. You've probably heard of all of these things, the tent of meeting. And of course, this was to be portable because they were going to wander for years, decades in the desert, as we know. from later on. And so whatever they had, they were nomadic, had to be portable. It wasn't until Solomon built the temple in Jerusalem that the dwelling place of God was a permanent building. So to begin with, it was a tent with a courtyard around it. And God, Yahweh here we're talking about, God in his aspect of Yahweh, gave Moses precise instructions with incredible number of details as to how he wanted this sanctuary made, this Mishkan, this dwelling place made, including the materials and how the sizes and how it was going to be put together. Moses got all that down, and then he went to the people, and he made an announcement about this, and he told the people, those whose hearts are moved to do so, bring us your gold, your silver, your bronze, acacia wood, finely embroidered woven linens, what else was there? Let's see, that red-dyed goat skin, precious stones, 12 different kinds, each one engraved with a name of one of Jacob's 12 sons, and bring all this stuff, and then we are craftsmen, certain craftsmen, which Yahweh pointed out, Bezalel, I think is how it's pronounced, going by memory here, that Yahweh had endowed with incredible skills just for this purpose. He will be in charge of the actual making and building of this. So the people started bringing all these materials, and they brought them. And finally, Bezalel sent word back to Moses, said, we've got enough. Tell them to stop bringing the stuff. We've got more than enough now. And so they put out the word, okay, that's enough. Thank you very much. And so they set to work, and they built this. And when they got it all done exactly as Moses had told them, they took it, presented it to Moses, and Moses presented it to God. And of course, it was found to be okay, to be acceptable to the Lord. Now, here's the passage that I want to talk about. Exodus 38:8 says, he made the bronze basin and its bronze stand from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Now, most people read this passage and they just buzz right on by. They think nothing more of it than it's an interesting but trivial detail. Yeah, okay, they made the bronze basin and its bronze stand from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. They just go on reading. Because I'll admit, it's pretty hard to read through all these details over and over. And it's kind of like almost like overkill when you're reading it. But there's a mystical reason for all of this. But anyway, this particular passage, you can look at this mystically for its hidden secrets and meanings that are relevant to the spiritual nature of God and man and their relationship. There's two things I want to point out about this. First, the verse is an obvious anachronism. It says, he made the bronze basin and its bronze stand from the mirrors of the women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Well, how could there be women who served at the entrance to the tent of meeting when the tent was not yet even made? That's what they're doing now. That's what he was making the wash basin for, out of bronze. He was hammering out their mirrors, these women's mirrors, to make into the wash basin. But wait a minute. It says he got these mirrors from the women who served at the tent of meeting. Past tense. Already in existence. That's an anachronism. A blip in time. I'm sure most people just buzzed right over that. Okay, well, what does this mean? It points something out. We have something to learn from that. And that is this. God is eternal. God is beyond all concepts of time. There is no past or future for God. God, as the Sufis remind us, who alone is truth, there is only an eternal present. In reality, we all exist in an eternal present. The future does not yet exist, and the past exists only in our minds in the form of memories. On the other hand, all moments in our lives exist in the present simultaneously. So it's kind of a paradox, but it's not really, if you think about it. God's dwelling, a tent of meeting, always has existed in God's mind, which is where this world exists. And the women have always served at its entrance. They didn't serve way back when, and they don't serve now. They're serving now. They continue to serve at the entrance of the tent of meeting even now. The key here is the word now. We live in one great, big, infinite, eternal now. Okay? Second, who are these women? The Bible doesn't say much about them. But in the context of the culture of the time, the ancient cultures and religions of the area, of the land of Canaan, of Persia, the Levantine culture and religion, what we're talking about, women who serve at the entrance of the tent, which is the equivalent of a temple, are temple prostitutes. Whoa! Now he's telling us that Moses is talking, Moses is attributed to having written all this down, of course. Remember, he got this all from God and wrote this down in the 40 days up there. And Moses is writing about temple prostitutes serving outside the tent of meeting, God's dwelling place. Women who stand outside the gates of the temple and are paid to have sex with men, in symbolic representation of the man having sex with a feminine deity. Well, there's another mind blower, right? Feminine deity. Yahweh's not feminine. No, but almost all the religions of the time either were at the time or came from divine mother religions, goddesses. There were Canaanite goddesses at the time, such as Ishtar, Ashtaroth, Astaroth. And God talks about them all the time and says, go, do not enter into their religion with them. Do not have your sons marry their daughters, or they'll corrupt them and they'll have them worshiping their idols and worshiping their religion. And when you get to their places of worship, tear down their phallic stones and destroy their idols. So we know that this existed at the time, both from the Bible and historical evidence, archaeological evidence and other. So that's what these women are. These are the women who stood outside and stand outside the entrance to the tent of meeting, outside the outer perimeter of screen cloth. It was 7.5 feet high, 5 cubits high. They plied their wares, their trade. They plied their trade. They sold their bodies to men who paid them so that they could engage in sex symbolically with the feminine deity. Well, now there's no feminine deity in Judaism. We all know that. In fact, that's one of the big put-downs by modern women of Judaism is its hostility toward the feminine. Well, I'm here to tell you there is a feminine aspect in Judaism. It's called the Shekinah. It's also called Bina. The Holy Mother is Bina. The Holy Daughter is the Shekinah. The bride to which Melchizedek will be married in the holy wedding, the Haros Gamos. Now then, about these mirrors. It says that the bronze mirrors were beaten into a wash basin to be used to cleanse and purify the high priest, which was Aaron, Moshe's brother, and his helper priests, which were Aaron's sons. Now, why on earth would that be the case? Why would God inspire Bezalel to use the bronze? Because he had his choice of bronze from anywhere. And I'm sure there was more of it than just the mirrors that were polished bronze that these temple prostitutes had to check their appearance and vanity. Why would God inspire him to use these mirrors? I mean, after all, that's kind of creepy, isn't it? The mirrors of prostitutes, which is dirty and, I mean, this is what we think, right? Dirty and evil prostitution is going to be used to make a basin in which water will be held that the high priest will wash his hands and his feet in to be purified before he goes in to approach the Ark of the Testimony and to perform his to light the lamps of the temple of the tent of meeting and to burn the incense and to serve God. Basically, he has to be purified before. How can you be purified by washing in a basin that's made out of the mirrors of temple prostitutes? It illustrates, here's the reason, this is what mysticism is about. It illustrates a fundamental teaching of Kabbalah, that out of great evil can come great good. And indeed, we are commanded to transform that which is evil into that which is good. So when the high priest washed, every time the high priest and his sons washed in that bronze basin, he looked into the water as into a mirror. And when he did so, the former image of the harlot, which was reflected in the metal of that mirror before, was transformed into the image of the high priest and his helper sons, his helper priests. And so, that which was evil was transformed by the hammer of Bezalel into that which is good. And that's one of the key precepts and teachings of Kabbalah, to transform that which is evil into that which is good. Because in everything that is evil, there is a spark of good trapped in it. Well, I've run way beyond our time that I'd planned on. I apologize. I'm happy for those who have stayed with this and stayed with us. And we will be meeting again. Our next meeting will be a worship service that I'll be holding on Erev Shabbat this Friday. And please visit our website at www.universalsabbateanchurch.org. And if you go to the page that's for audio lectures and worship services, you will find the schedule of our meetings. And then the next meeting of this class, in which we will continue and begin to teach Kabbalah, will be this upcoming Monday, same time. Will be the rebroadcast and it'll be 7 p.m. Eastern if you want to hear the live broadcast. Good night. Thank you. Zygesund.